Welcome to the April episode of OMP Clinical Care Insiders, an original podcast series produced by the American Academy of Orthotists and Prosthetists. My name is Seth O'Brien, Chief Clinical Officer at Wheeler OMP and Chair of the Academy's Scientific Societies Committee. This episode is sponsored by Forum. Today, we're recording live at the Academy's 50th annual meeting and scientific symposium from downtown Chicago, and I'm so happy to welcome Nicole Verkeilen, disability advocate and champion of the So Everybody Can Move initiative. Nicole, it's great to see you. Thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Seth, for having me.
How is Chicago treating you so far? We're towards the end of the week while we're here, but how are you holding up?
It's been great. The conference has been jam-packed. In front of us, there's a line of probably about 200 people, which is amazing. It seems like I brought the rain with me, though, from the West Coast, as it's raining here now.
As somebody from Phoenix, I will take every ounce of rain that I can get, whether it's at home or not. So thank you for that.
Absolutely.
So to go, I don't know if you remember this, but I have to go back to 2018, 19, somewhere in there. I go on a family trip with my wife and her family, and we went to Hawaii. We're going into this little bay to go snorkeling, and I'm around the rocks in this little tiny cutout cove. I'm like, okay, good. We're going to go post up over there, get out of the way, and then go in and go snorkeling, got the kids and everything. And as we're like laying towels down and getting situated, if I remember correctly, it was one of those, hey, nice leg. And I turn around, and there you are sitting there with your prosthetic leg as well and getting ready to snorkel. Oh, my gosh. What? At the time, I didn't know you at all, and it's so crazy to think now as just professionally as all of these things start to unfold. And I learned at that point a little bit about your Forrest Stump. Yeah. And as a triathlete myself, it was a lot of connections there. But it's crazy how our paths have crossed so many times over the years. Do you remember that at all?
Oh, my gosh. And it brings back such incredible memories and seeing you there. It's the incredible nature of this field that's so small. And so I always make a point, if I see someone who has a prosthesis, I want to say hi and welcome them into the community or just make sure that we know each other, because at some point we're going to cross paths. But I remember that moment distinctly because I was sitting on the rocks. I wasn't going in the water, but for one of the first times in my life, it wasn't because my prosthesis wasn't waterproof. It was because I had just had an accident while in Hawaii. I was climbing up on a bunch of rocks and I ended up falling and scraping my leg. And so I wasn't getting in the water because I was all scraped up. But that was by choice. And so that was like a very important moment in my life. It was like, here's the first time where I'm choosing not to go in the water, but not because I'm being limited by my prosthesis. And it was also 2 weeks before the paratriathlon national championship. So I remember I was training really hard for triathlon. I get injured. I have to stop training. And we chatted about your triathlon experience as well. And I think you gave me some incredible encouragement despite the injury at that time.
Oh, I doubt it, but thank you. And did you go on to still compete a couple weeks later?
I did. I texted my coach a picture of it was on my sound side, a bloody leg and a number of bruises. And he's like, all right, stop training right now. Just get healthy, heal up. So 2 weeks later, I competed in the 2019 Paratriathlon National Championships and ended up winning gold. So it was an incredible journey to get there, and I was really proud of that achievement.
Absolutely. That's amazing. I remember at first it was like probably 15, 20 minutes of chatting and getting to learn more about each other, and then just such a funny happenstance that we run into each other in this remote area of the world. And then, of course, like two amputees have to do is, what are you using? The swim fins and everything and using the foot, which I love. And then talking about your injury. And then I remember two other things. I remember thinking like, I'm glad you're not snorkeling at the moment because I don't want the sharks to come as you chum the water. So thank you. And then the other one was, I definitely now have to go find a new chunk of beach somewhere because we are definitely over quota for amputees in this snorkeling area
What are we to represent? We did a good job at that.
Absolutely. So moving on to, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have heard about some of the advocacy efforts, and we are in, I really believe, like we are just in an absolute heyday in terms of awareness and advocacy. And I think we're going to look back over the decades and see that this snapshot, maybe a 10-year period or so that we're in, I don't know if we're in the beginning of it or towards the tail end of it, but this is probably going to be one of those very, very monumentous times. But how did all of that kind of get started for you, and how did you get introduced, or when did you realize you wanted to get into this advocacy effort?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe we're truly at a pinnacle time in this advocacy journey, and the movement is just starting. But I think as advocates in the disability community, our time has come and it's growing. So that's incredible. But it wasn't like this back 20 plus years ago when I first had my leg amputated. So I was diagnosed with bone cancer when I was 10 years old, had my leg amputated at the Mayo Clinic, grew up in Minnesota, had the best possible care from a hospital standpoint going to the Mayo Clinic. But I was still, despite that, limited by my insurance mandated prosthesis, which was one prosthesis. You can't get it wet. That would be a convenience item to get a waterproof leg. And running is considered not medically necessary. And at the time, my family and I were really just dealing with the fact that I had just survived cancer. I'd gone through a year of chemo. We had countless medical bills that we were already trying to figure out how to pay off, trying to fight a denial from insurance and get access to a secondary prosthesis out of pocket was just not possible for my family and for many Minnesotan families. And we just went back and said, you know what, you're going to have to try and make do with what you have. And living in the land of 10,000 lakes with a leg that you're told you can't get wet was incredibly limiting. We would put trash bags and duct tape over it, trying to be able to go in the water. But as you can imagine, as a person with a disability, there's social and emotional sides to having a physical disability that is seen by other people. And so that was a very self-conscious thing that I had to deal with growing up and really ended up isolating myself from the water. So for us to see each other in Hawaii and have that moment be by choice that I wasn't going in the water was a full circle moment.
Sure.
But then as I grew older, was trying to participate in school sports, played on our softball team and gym class, and was continuously limited by my prosthesis and was breaking my foot all the time because I was trying to be physically active and had a lot of energy, and there's just no return on a limited foot that's just meant for walking.
Right.
And so as I got older, I ended up getting into my 20s, started training for my first half marathon with one of my best friends. And that's when it really started to wreak havoc on my overall body. And I was in physical therapy twice a week because I'd developed a sacral torsion, pelvic asymmetry, which basically meant I'd run my pelvis out of alignment, trying to run on a walking leg, and was actually breaking my foot every 6 months. And because of that, I decided to start questioning, why is it that I can't get access to a running blade? And I see these things in the media, people that have access to them, but yet I can't get access. And so that was really something that propelled me by necessity into this advocacy space and really questioning, what is it really that makes me disabled? Is it the fact that I'm missing my foot from a young age due to bone cancer? Or is it because of these outdated, really discriminatory policies that are keeping me from being able to have access to what I need to live an active life? And so with that, decided to quit my job and start an awareness journey and did a 1,500-mile triathlon down the West Coast, which we called Forest Stump, and did that to raise awareness on this issue. It was from Seattle to San Diego. When I got to the end in San Diego, really only because I'd become, in a sense, a public figure and had a documentary film crew following me, that I got noticed by a charity, and they were able to donate a running blade to me. And 16 years after I'd had my amputation, I finally got access to a running blade. And since then, it has incredibly changed my life, being able to have access to that. When I put the running blade on for the first time, I finally felt like I had my leg back.
That's amazing. And so many similarities or parallels between our stories. A little different for me, and a cancer survivor as well, synovial sarcoma, so a soft tissue tumor in the arch of my foot. But for me, a little bit different in that it wasn't until I was 24 that I got diagnosed. And then not necessarily going through those teenage years and after college. And so in a number of ways, didn't have to deal with maybe the same level of the social impact, but absolutely still a factor. And then ironically, my frustrations of not going back to things like snowboarding and running and doing triathlons and just having difficulty accomplishing those things or being able to do those things effectively, I just knew that that was not going to be a good long-term situation for me. So rather than quit my job and go into the advocacy field, I took the selfish path and became a prosthetist to try and figure out how to make these things for myself. But such an interesting parallel between our journeys. And I'm so glad that you are taking this on just absolutely front and center and head on in whatever analogy or whatever cliche we can throw at it. Tell us a little bit about this initiative started, that at least the one that you're on now. And every time I get so excited talking to people about the So Everybody Can Move initiative. And I'd love to hear you explain it a little bit, because my understanding is it started more so as So Kids Can Move, right? And really started to just snowball and pick up more steam. I always tell people that I am shocked that we are having, and we as a community, but mostly you and all of your efforts, right? But you're having so much success. I really thought that this would be a very difficult fight. And I'm just dying to understand like how this has become so embraced by the country so far and what your take is on that. Why are you finding so much success with this?
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you sharing your experience, because when I went off to do this 1,500-mile journey, I didn't know anyone really else in the disability community who used a prosthesis. I was incredibly isolated. I wasn't part of the OMP community. And so in many ways, I was like, man, did I just get really unlucky in terms of what I didn't have access to? But then hearing others' stories, it's the exact same thing. It's a systemic issue.
Yeah.
And so that's where I really started to try and dive in and figure out what is being done from a policy perspective on this. And this was back in 2017. And at that time, really nothing was being done at all. And I'd gone to AOPA policy forum to learn more. I went to the Amputee Coalition's Hill Day. I then moved to DC for 10 weeks to do a health policy and advocacy fellowship with the National Association for the Advancement of Orthotics and Prosthetics.
Oh, wow.
They had started this fellowship, so I was the inaugural fellow, shadowed under Peter Thomas, was able to get in contact with the OMP Alliance and attend those calls, and just started asking a bunch of questions in terms of, where are we at on this policy issue and what can we do about it? And I think at that time, it was still too early. There was still a lot of belief that this couldn't be done, and we weren't clear on what was the pathway to get there. And so I think part of this movement dating back to 2017 to now where we're at in 2024 has been really trying to figure out what is going to be the solution. And so in my background, I'm a business major, did strategy and marketing, which actually in many ways has served well, because this is really about storytelling and it's about the power of our story to get heard and the importance of creating a change. But really, I didn't have any perspective. So I just started asking a ton of people, like, what can we do? What are our options? And so I was able to get some great counsel from an individual who used to work for the Department of Justice, who worked on the Americans with Disabilities Act. And that really put Forrest Thump down a pathway of creating another awareness campaign that we called We Just Felt Like Running. So you can see Forrest Thump, We Just Felt Like Running. There's obviously some nods there to the one of my favorite films of all time. But during that process, she really opened up my eyes to the intersectionality of orthotics and prosthetics, to the broader assistive technology and rehabilitative services landscape. Individuals who utilize wheelchairs, individuals who need sighted guides. And so as part of that campaign, we had over 630 racers running across the country virtually, this was during COVID, in one day to advocate for the rights of people with disabilities to exercise. So building on the Americans with Disabilities Act of 1990. And through that, as I mentioned, we had over 600 people in one day. We ended up collecting close to 10,000 signatures on our petition to Congress and developed a policy paper with a number of solutions, potential policy solutions that were both federal and state, legislative and regulatory. So honestly, really big scope in terms of what we were providing. But we partnered with an AAOP, and so thankful to Peter Thomas and George Breese, who invited Forrest Thump to the table to provide this policy paper. And we met with 30 congressional offices, and it was incredible to see the reception. Like, there was interest in this needs to be done. But at that time, there wasn't really a consensus on what is the actual solution. What are we going to do to solve it? So in many ways, the seeds had been planted at that time. Because of COVID, things got delayed and went in a different direction. But what ended up coming from that was NAOP presented a proposal to AOPA to work on a policy initiative to define physical activity as medically necessary. And also during that time, I ended up joining AOPA, was hired to become our manager of public engagement, started working on this issue of defining physical activity as medically necessary. And about 4 months in to working at AOPA, was when I heard about a policy win in a little state, northeastern state of Maine. So that's where Jordan Simpson, an advocate who was born with limb difference, had worked with her representative to pass the first bill in the country that required insurance companies to cover prosthetics for physical activity for 18 and under. And what was unique about that legislation is that it built on 2 decades of legislation through the insurance fairness movement, which started in the early 2000s, first started in Colorado as a result of Dr. Jeff Kane, and was then implemented and enacted in over 21 states. What was incredible about that is it's much easier to enact policy in a state that is already in existence, right? We're just amending an existing bill that's been on law for potentially 20 years and adding a little bit to it. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Maine did, and that's why it was receptive. They had to negotiate to just children. But as soon as I heard about that win, it was like it clicked, right? Like this could be a movement. This could be something that we can build on. Yeah. And so that's where we started getting into this concept of so kids can move and figuring out like, let's pilot this. Let's see if this is something that other states can grasp onto and start introducing. So we created model legislation from that, started getting the word out. And the pushback really came from the community saying, why just kids? What about all ages? And so that for me, as an individual who's no longer a child and is 31 years old, I was rooting for that. And yeah. So we started seeing some incredible success with states starting to pursue more than just children.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our episode sponsor, Vorum. Are you looking to move to a digital O&P solution? Quadra, the global leader of digital transformation, are dedicated to creating new opportunities for the O&P industry. Quadra emerges from the synergy of 3 industry pioneers. Quadra are uniting Vorum, Rodin 4D, and TechMed 3D to redefine digital solutions in O&P and podiatry industries. We are combining our strengths to provide the best solutions. Visit our new website, quadra.com, to discover our scanning, computer design, and manufacturing solutions.
It makes perfect sense in hindsight, right? I think it's so much harder to just be argumentative when we're talking about everybody puts on there, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You can't really argue against kids, right? But then when you start to see some of the merits of it and you start to understand, oh yeah, okay, so all of these things that we can now agree on, they don't stop when you turn 19 or 21 or whatever it is, right? If anything, as I'm learning at 41, I need to run a lot more than I ran at 19 in order to not be horribly out of shape. But it's just amazing. And that's really where I always thought that I always believed that it would happen, it would get there. But I always just thought being in the space and in the profession and knowing how these things go, it's going to be chipping away. And so it's just so exciting to see the success that's being done. And also, it's interesting to hear you talk about that because it's in a lot of ways, I think it's like see a parallel between, this is going to be a very random comparison, but movie stars, right? It's, man, they just burst onto the scene out of nowhere, had this one movie, and now they're just in everything. And then you hear them talk about their story. It's, no, I was doing casting calls for 25 years or these little tiny like commercials or pilot shows that didn't get picked up and told that I'll never be any good. And then all of a sudden it just clicks and that one opportunity that spirals. And I didn't even know all of the background of this was chipping away for the last 10, 15, maybe 20 plus years and just hitting the right timing at the, you know, with the right situation. And now we're almost appears from the outside as lightning in a bottle, right?
Yeah, absolutely. This movement builds on, as I mentioned, the insurance fairness movement, which was over 2 decades. And then plus, you know, all of the work that we've been doing to generate interest and feedback on what could potentially be the policy solution. And so once we found that fit, that's really where this has just, as you mentioned, has been lightning and just taking off. And I think the other unique part of this too is that all the players are at the tables. The founding partners of what is now So Everybody Can Move are the Academy, AOPA, the National Association for the Advancement of Orthotics and Prosthetics, NAOP, and also the Amputee Coalition. And I think that is an incredibly unique part of this movement that has allowed it to take off in the way that it has, is having this collaboration of all of these organizations coming together and saying this needs to change. And we're going to bring the unique talents that we each have as organizations and our networks to the table to make sure that this happens. I think that's another key part of why this is now taking off in the way that it is.
Absolutely. And so everybody can move. I think, did I say so everyone can move earlier? I probably found a way to butcher it.
People have said so everyone can move. which is fine. I think...
No, it's not. You can tell me. No, that was just dumb and it was wrong.
No, it's all right. I think what we want to try and get people to say is so everybody can move, because this is really about the disability community and our bodies and every person. I think you've probably heard the saying from Nike, if you have a body, you're an athlete. And I think that's where that's alluding to that side of it and trying to bring the disability side of this as well.
So back to the success that you're having, the impact is huge. Now, are these numbers even still accurate? These are numbers that we talked about maybe a few weeks ago, but I think there may have been some movement already on these. But so far, when we talked last, it was 5 states that had already enacted legislation. Is that still correct?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And then how about, is it introduced officially in other states? I think we were at 8 before. And is that still the same, or has there been movement there?
Yes, correct. The 5 states that have now enacted this include Illinois, New Mexico, Arkansas, Colorado, and then Maine, which is the first, which is incredible. We're seeing this as very... a bipartisan, if not nonpartisan issue. That's why it's really getting across. The O&P story is something that everyone can get behind in terms of mobility, chasing your human potential. As you mentioned, it's hard to say no to children. They're still our secret weapon, despite the name now being so everybody can move. But yeah,
that's why I act like a kid all the time. And sometimes it works, but usually not.
Absolutely. That definitely resonates with the legislators. But yeah, and then we've got 8 states now that just this year have introduced legislation. If you look at, that's an incredible amount of legislative activity that's happened in just 2 years, to have that many states have taken some sort of legislative action, whether enacting a bill. And many of these bills have gotten through in the first year, which is also very uncommon. And then to have 8 more that have been introduced, and those include Maryland, Minnesota, Indiana, New Hampshire, New Jersey, Massachusetts, Tennessee, and Florida. But I will also say the incredible thing about this effort, too, is that So Everybody Can Move is also inspiring grassroots advocates to introduce the foundational legislation of insurance fairness. Right. So as I had mentioned, insurance fairness had gotten 21 states, which is so close to the 25 mark that you need. Over 25 states to have a majority of U.S. states to then pursue a federal bill. And what we've seen is that this movement has now inspired additional states to go after insurance fairness and add that. For example, Nebraska also has a bill this year for insurance fairness, and Oregon last year was able to reinstate an insurance fairness bill. So in addition to the 5 and the 8 that we just mentioned, there's 2 more that have come to the table to play. And so what we're seeing, and what our ultimate goal is, to get 28 states to enact this legislation by the Los Angeles 2028 Paralympics.
Okay.
And we think there's going to be a lot of synergy with the Paralympics disability movement that's surrounded in that, coming to the U.S., coming to U.S. soil, and being able to change policy as a result at a national level. So over 25 states, and then we can go for a national legislation.
Absolutely. And I have always had an interest, obviously, being so personally connected to the field, as you can attest to and you've spoken to. But when I did a residency in San Antonio and practiced there for about 3 years or so, and was always very keen on the legislative and the advocacy efforts, but knowing from working with one of my mentors out there that was highly involved in that, and just knowing the frustrations and how slow it was and getting right to the doorstep and then not making it through in a session, and then it has to start all over again. And that's the other part of this that is just unheard of almost, is how quickly things are getting through. And I even to the point, I had a colleague text me a while back, and maybe a couple of years ago or so, and sends me a text and just says, I have a personal connection with a legislator, and they said they want to introduce this bill. I know you're connected. What do you think? And I was like, that's amazing. I don't know, but I know somebody who does know, and knowing about your efforts and connecting them with AOBA and with you and just this whole movement. And it's just crazy to see that in some circumstances, this is actually, we were floored to find out that legislator did all of the work of actually adopt and revising the legislation and creating their own one from the template that was done in Maine, right? It wasn't something that we as a profession had to spoon feed to them. And it blows my mind that we're getting that kind of result, and just those things are happening.
Yeah, and it's a testament to our state leads. I'm working at the national level, trying to bring us together to define this as a national movement. But our state leads are the ones that are on the ground doing the work, getting these bills passed. And all credit goes out to them and the work that they're doing. And I think what's incredibly unique and exciting about this initiative is that we're inspiring people who maybe not did not have advocacy or policy as their background, but are just so motivated to make a change for their patients or for them themselves, if they're part of the limb loss and limb difference community, to take action to make a change. And we've got individuals like Angela Montgomery, a CPO in Colorado, who led the charge this past year and got it passed. We've got Jim Kaiser in Illinois. We've got Cheryl Sachs in Maryland. We've got Joe Huntsman in Tennessee and Kyle Stepp in New Mexico. And the list goes on and on. I could be listing out all of the different individuals, but I think that's so incredible about the field is that advocacy is becoming part of what we need to do as a profession to make sure that we're standing up and we're voicing what people need access to. And I've just been incredibly impressed with the work that they're doing on the ground to create these core teams, to create these coalitions, and to inspire grassroots advocates at a level that we haven't seen before.
Absolutely. And it's great. You've heard it before, I'm sure, and I'll echo it. But just at a time where there's very few issues that are bipartisan, it's the absolute perfect time for us to introduce topics that can be and easily can be. I've started to support the efforts in Arizona with the lead advocates there and want to see that succeed there. And it's great to see there's multiple different competitors in the Phoenix area that are all coming together to help get this thing through, because it's going to span really all dividing lines across all kinds of aspects of our life.
Yeah, it's funny to say this, but this is a really, it's a fun bill for legislators.
Sure.
Because there is a lot that's, as you mentioned, going through legislators right now that is not bipartisan and has a lot of debate to it. But having a bill like this, when you've got the children up there showing off their running blades and they're testifying and they're sharing how they were able to make it on to their school baseball team, or how they were able to go rock climbing or do something that they'd never done before, that touches the hearts and the minds of these legislators. And I remember in supporting Colorado and their work, watching from afar as the testimony was given, those exact words were shared by the legislators in terms of, this is a relief to work on something like this. And they've also said things like, this should have been done before. I remember one legislator in Colorado who said, I am so excited to vote yes to get this passed out of this committee, but I wish I didn't have to. This is something that should have been done decades ago. And so I think that's really what has been so powerful about this movement, is being able to show that it's the disability community's time to be able to have access to this. And I think disability has become more acceptable and accessible just to a general public than it has been.
On behalf of the limb loss and limb difference community and on behalf of the profession, congratulations and thank you. And I'm so glad to have you kind of at the helm of this thing, along with a very talented team. I'm sure it's not just you, and I know that for a fact, and you're the first one to say it, but you are absolutely the champion of this at the moment, and that's amazing. Everybody who listens to this should get involved, should support the efforts, and I think will want to know how they can support it. So what is needed at this point? What's next?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm excited to share that we're launching a website next week, so everybodycanmove.org, which is going to be a great way for people to go and learn and just educate themselves on where we're at. If they're in a state that they want to get involved with, they're going to be able to easily fill out some information to join a state coalition. But beyond that, we definitely need funding. And that is a big part of the fundraising work that we're doing right now. We're being, in many ways, very scrappy with what we've been doing so far. But the way that we're truly going to be able to grow this and get to that 28 states by 2028 is through investment. So that's something that, as an example, we're going to be doing a fundraising campaign this coming July. We're calling it the 28 by 28 Mobility Challenge. People can sign up, create teams, there'll be prizes. On Running is sponsoring this 28 by 28 mobility challenge. If you're familiar with their shoes, I wear the Cloud Monsters in my own running and training currently for the Boston Marathon. But they're going to have a bunch of giveaways, including shoes, running shorts, everything. And we're going to get some other sponsors on board to make it a fun, dynamic, and hopefully maybe competitive between groups. But that'll be one fundraising opportunity. But yeah, we definitely are making a call for other groups to get involved and make an investment in this initiative. And in terms of, yes, the bills have been flying through in many ways, but we're still up against a side of this that's about the cost. What is this going to cost? Mm-hmm. And that's where we really need to double down and be able to answer the fiscal side of this to show this isn't going to cost a lot of money. This is actually savings overall. This is going to lead to healthcare savings because people are going to be more physically active. less rates of obesity and diabetes and just the mental health side of it too, and prevention of depression, and really trying to find the answer to what is the cost of doing nothing. And that's a term that I've heard from Susan Pinkwater, who has led the adaptive sports movement. But there's a cost to not providing this. So that's what we need to be able to show legislators. If someone's listening to this and they're a researcher and they want to get involved, I want to inspire them that you've got a role in this too. We have many different ways that advocates can get involved, whether it's going and testifying, finding individuals with limb loss and limb difference to share their stories, donating to the cause, and providing research. Lots of ways to volunteer and get involved.
That's incredible. Thank you again. It's probably the issue that I am just the most excited about across our field in general, obviously for very selfish reasons, but that's what got me into the field in the first place, right? A totally selfish decision in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. When you said that a selfish decision, I would not consider it selfish to advocate for your own needs, right? You were an advocate for what you needed. And by doing that, honestly, it's a very selfless thing too, because you are deciding to dedicate yourself to a career that could then give back to other people who are just like you. So I think that's truly commendable. And we need every type of person in this, whether you are the policy brains or the advocacy brains. We also need the clinical brains to this as well, because that's going to be a side of this that I'm personally incredibly excited to see, is how this movement is going to lead to advancements in care and how it's going to raise our standard of care. And as me as an individual, what access is this going to look like for the future of activity-specific prosthetics and orthotics too?
And Nicole, thank you so much. Thanks for all that you do and continue to do. And thank you for joining us today. It's been incredible.
Thanks so much for having me, Seth. This has been great.
And thanks to all of you out there for listening to this episode of OMP Clinical Care Insiders. And we want to give a big thank you once again to our episode sponsor, Vorum. I hope you'll join us each month as we continue our conversation with key voices in the OMP community, discussing their areas of clinical care and sharing personal experiences as professionals in that specialty. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, Google, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And don't forget to check out the Academy's award-winning podcast for OMP professionals, OMP Research Insights with Dr. Steve Gard, and OMP Rising, a podcast created for emerging professionals in our field. For more information on the American Academy of Orthotists and Prosthetists, visit us online at onp.org. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time.